Good evening, everyone. As we predicted last week, this is 7 o'clock. It's Wednesday night, and this is the ABD Guidebook by E.J. Gold. Now, this is class 13, lucky 13. So we've made it that far, and that's a good thing. We're reviewing a book together that has got unusual depth to it. And so our technique is that we have created subgroups, or maybe it's subspecies. Of,
No.
And each group has taken on the task of delving into each of the different groups. And we had a remarkable, a few weeks ago, revelation, really, of book one, Law. And now we've made our way to book two, which is Ur-Rahman. And we had the first start of that last week, which was a stirring beginning. It really opened that book up for us, I think. And we were able to touch into some areas of compassion and unbounded love that I've never seen before. And are we ready over there, Dan? Dan's ready. I'm ready. We're all ready. And so what I'd like to do is hand it over now to Ivan, and he's going to guide us through the second part of Book 2, Ur-Rahman.
Thank you, David. I thought we would begin tonight with the musical interlude instead of ending with it. Begin tonight with verse 11 from Book 2, Ur-Rahman. I'll read this one verse, 11. And now shall he meditate upon me and upon my infinite compassion, and he shall be bathed in compassion as if he were the reflection of the moon upon the water, and he shall be as if existing and yet not existing in himself, and he shall meditate upon himself as the clear light itself, and he shall see me before him as if I were the reflection of his own spiritual nature. I would say that in our group, we were all struck by this section of the book in various ways. And the idea, the reaction, let's say, that I had to that passage, the verses 7 through 11, and particularly that verse, which I just read, was that compared to the parallel passage in the Red Book, in the American Book of the Dead, it struck me that this wording here, this formulation of this idea of the moon reflected in the water, or like the, you know, it's a, there's a lot of stories about this. I think it's an image that comes from Zen Buddhism, and I think it's actually very widespread in other traditions of the moon floating in a teacup, and there's a lot of different contexts for this. But in this wording that I just read, what struck me very strongly about it is that the notion of the reflection, that one is the reflection of the other, it seemed to me that in this book, the Ur-Rahman is, I look in the water, I see the reflection of myself as the voyager, let's say. He who is getting the instructions read to him sees his reflection as Ur-Rahman. So the voyager is Ur-Rahman. And then the guide, let's say, the person, the reader, if I'm reading these instructions, it feels to me like I also see my reflection in the water, and I see myself as Ur-Rahman, and I see that I am the clear light itself. And so the feeling that I get from it is that all of these streams are merged. I think there's something, wasn't there something Grant said in regarding the Book of Allah about the streams of consciousness. Streams of consciousness are all joined. It seemed to me that the imagery here suggests that the reflection and the object that's the reality that's being reflected, and the one who's seeing the reflection, and the one who's experiencing the reflection being seen while it's reflecting, and so on. Well, you know, all of this to me suggests a unity of these things, and I think alchemy had something to say about this also. I wonder if she, even if we touched on it last week, maybe she could say a little bit about this. With us, Alka?
Yes, Ivan. It's a beautiful, beautiful observation.
A little louder.
Speak up. Yes. Okay.
Good.
Is this loud enough?
Yes.
Is it better?
Yes.
Okay. So yes, it's a nice interpretation that you have given right now of one reflecting the other. It was, for me, it was an it holds true. I think it was there in my mind somewhere, but you have put it in words, so it manifests itself now. The idea of the divinity reflecting in you when you become hollow, when you become formless and you become subtle and you become fluid, was my only observation, that you have to let the ego go. You have to, again, I can pull out references, but I think that's all right from Ramdas. But yeah, the idea that you have to empty yourself of all the emotions, you have to be like an empty vessel which is willing to accommodate something rather than being filled with the emotional bit.
A little bit louder. Okay, a little louder.
Yeah, so, okay. Is this better?
Much better,
yes.
Okay, so
slowly. Why don't you say what you just said again more slowly?
So I'm saying that the idea of becoming like an empty vessel or like water is required for the interaction with Ur-Rahman. You have to, when you say that the divine reflects upon you, it can reflect upon you only when you're clear. If you're clear and fluid like water. So it's about giving off the passionate side, which is full of emotions and, you know, grief and anger and hunger and whatever, and be like Ur-Rahman, which is, as the this is the right time to touch upon the topic of detachment, but detachment is dispassionate compassion is what is required. So you have to not be passionate, but you have to be compassionate, which is understanding the other, again bringing us to the idea of unity. But yeah, I think it's all interlinked. So you have to be the other, you have to be, when you are the other, then there is no scope of being whatever forms are manifesting in you, then you are just empty. And when you, the other, when you joining with the other, which is so divine, then these things have to first, you know, make way for that to happen, which I found to be the interpretation of moon reflecting upon water. But Ivan's interpretation of, you know, reflecting, everything is reflecting each other is, I think, a better interpretation, but I think it's all connected. Everything is reflecting each other.
Okay, good. Thank you, Alka. Yeah, I think that, you know, especially I think in the Red Book, in the American Book of the Dead, when this imagery comes up, I think it's meant to suggest that there's a reality, you know, that the reality of this clear light, let's say the radiance, the persona that's the clear, I am the voidness of the void. If I experience myself as the clear light, that it is a reality that's not like a material reality. So it's like the reflection of the moon in the water. It's real, but it's, if I touch it, I'm not touching the moon. It's a reflection of the moon. That's what I get out of it. But in this, I think there's, it's almost like a koan, I believe, in this verse 11, you could actually keep, you could meditate on this, just this verse, on the formulation there of the, what is reflecting what, and what am I, if I look at my reflection and see Ur Rahman, what am I, who am I? And of course, in a sense, one of the things that I think that we spoke of last week is that in this book, or did we get to that? Alka, why don't we bring that up right now? I had it a little later on, I think, but this the fact that there are the three different personas or entities in this book. Would you say something about that? It's in these notes somewhere.
Yeah, no, I removed it from the notes, Ivan. I think
it's louder. You need to be louder.
Yes, I'm saying I removed it from the notes because in this particular book, unlike book 1 and book 3, there are only two participants, which is Ur Rahman and the Voyager. There is no intermediate in this book, so there's only two. That's
okay.
Why I removed it from the notes.
Don't feel that it also invokes the reader? That the guide is reading the instructions? Maybe not. Okay, well maybe this is a point we can look at it as a whole class. But let's say, is Molly on with us? Molly on the phone? Is she online? Okay, well, we were hoping she was going to read this Rumi poem, which is related to the reflection. I wonder if she can call.
Yeah. I wanted to make a comment about that.
Please.
We're waiting for Molly to get on.
Yeah.
The reflection of, or the concept of, like, the moon upon the water, is that the phrase, Ivan?
Yeah.
Moon upon the water. That's an illusion, right?
Yeah, that's the idea, but it's a reality that's an illusion because it's a reflection.
But it's a reality. It's an illusion. But if I am in the space such that I can see that, it is a reality for me in that space, and it feeds me in that way.
See, here's one of the lines here in verse 11, and he shall be as if existing, and yet not existing in himself.
Right. That
yeah.
makes sense.
And I think there's quite a lot in this book that has to do with the limited self versus the unlimited, you know, the unbounded self, the the self that is the clear light itself, or that is the guide, that is Ur-Rahman, let's say, that is the unlimited ocean of compassion, or the source of love. You know, and the two things are set next to one another several times in this book. Is Molly getting able to get on the phone, Dan? Just to introduce this idea in our notes, just this subtlety of the reflection. There's oh, okay. Okay. Well, you want to try that? The I know I can send it. Okay. I found the particular poem which I put in the documents, you know, in the archive that David posted for us for the Book of Ur-Rahman, and it's hard to select among Rumi poems because there are so many that are so very beautiful and so expressive, you know, and so they're so powerfully spiritual. It's sort of like the feeling I get. I like to read Rumi because, being a poet myself, when I read Rumi, I get this. It's like a very positive influence for a writer, because Rumi is all of these, the Masnavi and these hundreds and thousands of poems that he wrote for his teacher, for his beloved Shams of Tabriz, so on. They're all coming from a completely non-material perspective. They're so spiritual, you know. They're so entirely sort of other dimensional or higher dimensional, or you know, from they come from a very, very unbounded reality, from a very unboundaried place, and it's just I always find them, just about any little verses of any length from Rumi, I find very stimulating and actually sometimes mind-boggling, or you know, a kick in the head, or sometimes a kick in the pants, or whatever. They're telling me that there is this other reality. There is this more spiritual world, or there is the world of being and essence, which it's possible to actually stand in, you know, to see from or to see through. And if Molly joins us, she was going to read for us this particular poem, which carries the this same image, or a very similar image, of the reflection in the mirror, of what you see when you see your reflection. If she's not able to speak on the microphone, we'll read it here.
Molly, I don't know if you can hear us, but see if you can speak into your second life and we can pick you up. Type that into the log, too, please. Okay. Okay, try to speak now. Try to speak to your second life microphone.
I picture.
She has a dot.
So there it is.
You, no luck, she's saying. Okay. Well, we'll read it here then, okay? Just listen on live stream and you get to hear it too.
Okay, so this, I'll read this Rumi poem. This is translated by Coleman Barks from the Persian. It's called Out in Empty Sky. If you catch a fragrance of the unseen like that, you won't be able to be contained. You'll be out in empty sky. Any beauty the world has, any desire, will easily be yours. As you live deeper in the heart, the mirror gets clearer and cleaner. Shams of Tabriz realized God in himself. When that happens, you have no anxieties about losing anyone or anything. You break the spells human difficulties cause. Interpretations come hundreds from all the religious symbols and parables and prayers. You know what they mean when God lives through you like Shams.
Is that in the material?
Yeah, that's posted.
Yeah. So I've uploaded all of this material that this group is working from. It's on the website under Book 2, and I'm going to go grab a copy of that poem and share with a couple of people.
Yeah, let me repeat.
Great find.
Yeah, let me repeat these lines in here that says, as you live deeper in the heart, the mirror gets clearer and cleaner. And I think that's a wonderful formulation of what alchemy was.
Exactly my thoughts when you reside quietly in your rhythm and movement towards your light. Each time I read a thing like this, it just grows deeper. And this poem is like a summary of the entire chapter, I think.
Yeah. Well, it also it also feels it's almost like a little bit of a reminder to us, I think, in our group, or almost like a chastisement, that if you go and try to unravel the symbols and meanings of all the different religions and so on, eventually you get to a unity.
Read that first phrase, though.
The first phrase?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, the poem is called Out in Empty Sky, so, you might think of that as a clear light. If you catch a fragrance of the unseen,
when you catch a fragrance of the unseen,
yeah, like that, you won't be able to be contained.
So, what
what happens when you're not able to be contained?
Well,
that's anyway. Okay. Well, you know what? I think we don't have a lot more in this presentation, but I think that what we should do is present you a few more ideas to the class here, and then I would like to ask a few questions and see if people have comments or could participate in helping us understand some of these ideas in this book. But Pani is going to offer another Buddhist piece, is that right? Yeah, do you want to do that now? Yeah, sure. She has another piece on compassion that reflects on this material we've been reading as well. Let me get to the phone.
Happy Suffering, a prayer for travelers in this world, by Its Eminence Sen Rinpoche. Wherever I go or don't go, everything I do can become Dharma, because I do it with a Dharma motivation. Dharma motivation arises from compassion. Compassion arises from seeing so many beings suffer so much, not knowing why, not knowing what to do. To liberate the precious beings in the hells created by hatred, suffering, and unbearable pain, I go on this journey. To liberate the precious hungry ghosts suffering the bottomless hunger and thirst of miserliness, I go on this journey. To liberate the precious animals suffering helplessly and speechlessly, I go on this journey. To liberate the precious human beings suffering from endless and unfulfilled desire, bleeding on the battlefields of birth and death, soon reaping the bitter harvest of greed and anger, I go on this journey. To liberate the demigods raging with the suffering of jealousy, and the long life gods blinded with the suffering of pride, I go on this journey. For all who cannot join me, I go on this journey. For those who have never even heard the word Dharma, I go on this journey because I care and cannot bear to see their pain any longer. To connect them with the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, I rejoice in any difficulties and problems and absorb them for the benefit of all. Not what I want, I will do, but what they need. I pray to my most holy Guru, who is one with my Yidam and protector, who took this journey before alone and with so much more hardship than me. Please send me hunger and thirst, pain and exhaustion, sickness and poverty, abuse and loneliness. And may I purify the hurts and harms and difficulties of all mother beings and myself by absorbing and enduring them happily. In this way, suffering becomes joy and every part of the journey, happiness. Thank you.
Thank you. What is that called?
Happy suffering.
be suffering.
David, will that be posted also?
If you write it, I'll put it up there, okay?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Annie.
Thank you.
She posted it. We posted a different text in our document, and then she can add this one there.
Thank you.
I think what I would like to ask people at this point, you know, these prayers, these Buddhist prayers or invocations, these seem to be really the Bodhisattva vow. I mean, they seem like they're coming from very accomplished practitioners, you know, right? From people who are practicing this Bodhisattva.
They're seeking this.
Yeah, way of life, or, you know, in the Buddhist path. And I wonder, you know, I thought that, David, it was interesting that you sent around an exercise, a suggestion for an exercise. You know, I'm wondering if people listening here to us have examples or even ideas of what, you know, what would be beginning steps towards what this viewpoint, you know, standpoint, let's say, the view that Michelle was just reading about in these, you know, these Buddhist texts that she found and the suggestions of the Dalai Lama, they're very advanced, compassionate beings. But what would be first steps? You know, what would be a beginning on that, in that direction? Would you say something about the one that you circulated?
I would like to.
I don't know if everybody read it or not.
Yeah. Well, I was reading through the document that this group put together. Was quite extensive. It was like really active, you know, the work you guys did.
A lot of stuff there, yeah.
A lot of stuff up there, and I posted it. And I started wondering what then, well, in there, in the discussion, if you read through it, there's a lot about compassion, but there's also unconditional love comes through. Because if you start thinking about it, if you have unconditional compassion, there's no holes barred. You have compassion, and then it comes into this area of love. So I'm reading all this stuff, and I go, wow, those are really, really high beings, right?
That's what I'm thinking.
Those really high beings,
right.
And they can do this, and they can, they. But it can't be like that. There's got to be a way in for us students, us beginners, us intermediate. And so what I started thinking about was that all day long, I'm like offered moments, opportunities for compassion and love. All day long, I might see a beautiful flower or a tree or a sight that just, and normally what I do then is I say, oh, that's beautiful. I look outside myself. That is beautiful or not beautiful, right? And it struck me, maybe I could see, when I see something like that, which I do all day long, it's like all day long we're being offered the opportunity to practice compassion and love in this way. Where is it resonating in me at that moment? And if I can see where it's resonating in me, then I can practice that compassion. So it's just that idea of how do I practice it? Well, like I'm given the opportunity all day long.
Right, and you're saying, let me see if I understand it. What you're recommending is to try, instead of paying attention to the object, to what is, oh, this is what's drawing me, this is what's making me feel strongly, or this is changing my state to see this person or this beautiful scene or this someone I haven't met for a while or whatever. And then so you turn your attention to what is the source of that feeling. It's like the, like EJ's exercise, I place my attention on the source of attention. Oh, yeah, that's simple. Just go ahead. Just do it. Do it all day long.
Because when I can open that up more and I become less dependent on the object entertaining me,
mm-hmm.
and I'm just in that being, then I can start opening my eyes. Listen to this guy here, that what he had to say. I mean, this guy said, show me poverty.
Mm-hmm.
Wait, show me pain. Bring it forth.
Yeah, here I'm going through all the world, all this, the six worlds, you know. Also
and the reason is
the brute world and the human world and the demigods and so on.
Because he is not dependent on them entertaining him.
Mm-hmm.
He can be with them. And if you can be with somebody at that moment, you can begin to experience the first sensations of true compassion, and you can just be with them. You don't need anything from them. You don't want anything. You can be with them. I call that the first level of objective interest, okay?
The first level of objective interest, okay.
At that level, right. You can actually see the person rather than, oh, what are they going to do for me? Or I don't like them or something. It's just you notice them with a certain clarity of vision.
Mm-hmm.
And if you do that, the next step is you start to see, that's me.
Oh, yeah. See, I'm thinking, like, suppose I could say to myself, not, like, what's my reaction, or not, like, this is my opinion or my judgment or whatever of this other person's behavior. What if I could empathize, you know, if I say to myself, suppose I were that person looking at me, or suppose in this situation I weren't myself, I was that other person, how would that feel? How would I be?
Well, I got an example.
Yeah, because I'm just thinking that would be steps on the way to actually feeling the completely undifferentiated.
If you will, I'm going to give you an
compassion.
Example.
Yeah.
It's a little personal.
Okay, well, we can live with that.
Well, we'll see.
Okay.
So Ivan came in to dinner tonight, and he sat down, and his right eye was...
Yeah, I decided to mask it here.
It was weird, and it bothered me. Okay?
Yeah.
It bothered me, and I kept looking at it, and at some point, I just stayed with it, and then it flipped. And I started wondering, what does it feel like right now for Ivan to have that sensation? What is the sensation in Ivan? And I don't know what that feels like, because I don't think I have that in my eye, but I suddenly was in a certain way with your eye, and that you were walking with that.
Mm-hmm.
And when I came up here with you, I felt like I wanted to care for you. I wanted to make sure that you were okay.
Mm-hmm.
Now, this was not in sentimentality or in sympathy, but in empathy.
Empathy, yeah. Well, that's good.
And it freed me in a certain way. It totally freed me from that bothered me.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I said, why don't you get the phone while I'm setting up the computer, I started worrying, wait a minute, I'll go get the phone. Because I don't know if he can get the phone. Because I don't know what it's going to be like when he bends underneath there.
I'm not too bad with
Well, I'm just telling you.
Still all right with one eye.
But I'm not talking about you.
Yeah. Okay.
I'm talking about the mechanism that went on in me. I had to shift it from how you affect me to what was the sensation in this thing here. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
And I found it. That's all.
Well, yeah, I felt like I couldn't read very well with it, with this eye.
But he did.
Misbehaving. Well, I masked it so that it wasn't missing. It wasn't misbehaving. The other eye together. Did you have a comment? Hold on. Okay.
I just want to say that the feeling of gratitude helps to open a door towards compassion, as from my own experience, and to appreciate and to have gratitude for being here and being alive and being able to do work. And to remember that, and to, even in difficult time, it helps to open the heart. So I think it depends, but for me gratitude has been a help for that. But not at first, but it's just become more and more now clear as we work up with compassion. And I also try to work with compassion, like wake up in the morning and say, okay, what is it to have a day of compassion? And so I have a glimpse of compassion because I don't hold it very long. But when I do have those glimpses of compassion, everything is just fine and I can just be. And it's very short times. But I experienced that by trying to use compassion as a tool to be more aware.
I call that you're placing pennies into your essence bank. Mm-hmm. Each time you get a little glimpse of it, mm-hmm. it's there. Mm-hmm. Right? That's cool. Go ahead, then.
Could I say something else, David?
Alka's got
Hang on one second, Alka.
Hawk Lady has a question. So locate the beauty within, the poverty within, etc. Is this correct? And then Lara says, I take on your pain and give you my joy, a Buddhist phrase.
Yeah, I think that would be after a great deal of baby steps. You know, that would be after a lot of practice. I could take on your pain and give you my joy. But do you want to answer Hawk Lady's question?
I was hoping you were answering right there.
Read that again, Dan, would you?
So locate the beauty within, the poverty within, etc. Is this correct?
Yes, I would say so. It's what, if you can find it in yourself, then you're, this is empathy. In other words, if you, it's not alien, it's not other, not strange to you. It's not something separated from you by a boundary. And I think
right.
that I'm thinking that, you know, small steps during your daytime activities along the lines that Michelle is talking about here would be building, you know, up, building on your ability to open up to this really tremendous, you know, the experience of the all of the suffering that's on the human level, you know, as in this Buddhist text, all the suffering that's on the level of the hungry ghosts. You know, you see, actually, all you need to do is, it's been my experience that if you turn on the television and switch between channels, you can see a lot of the suffering of hungry ghosts. And the, you know, the question is, can you absorb that? Can you expand, get large enough? Can you reflect that, let's say, in your clear light mirror?
Let me ask Hawk Lady a question. Like, you have a great deal of passion for your dogs. What is that? Exactly, what is the, how does that exactly work in you? That you have that, and that's the root of it. In it, you're going to see things like understanding, you're going to see gratitude, you're going to see these elements work. Why do you, how, not why, how does it work in you? It flows naturally when you do this with your dogs. And I'm just saying that that particular thing, start looking inward as to how it works in you. Because then when you're at the store and you see somebody, maybe you can not react. Like, I don't know how Ivan feels. I really don't. I don't have that thing in his, in my eye. I might tomorrow or later on, but I don't right now.
The wind's blowing outside.
Yeah, so he has that. I don't know what it is, but I'm not afraid of it anymore. You know what I mean? I can be with him in that eye. And there's a certain, and when I am, when I can just be with it for a moment, Ivan, then this other mechanism starts to work. I don't react, I be with it. Presence and attention, I'm just with you.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
See, that's my interpretation of the of Rumi's image, or his, what is it, what would you call it? It's an analogy out in empty sky. This is like the fair witness, you know, like being detached, being fully present, but being a witness, being detached. See what it says here in this book of Ur-Rahman. It says, find the passage. Oh yeah, here, in the very last verse, in 19, I was very struck by this. Times, but 19, the end of this book says, and the secondary light shall awaken in him the body of thoughts and desires. Okay, this is going from, let's say, the stasis, you know, from this moment of freedom, sort of in the clear light. Now comes the body of thoughts and desires. And the inner witness shall remain as the knower of all things. So this is, I found this very interesting. So here is the observer. The inner witness is still there. And the center of images shall be those of his former surroundings. And he shall not know himself, nor shall he know his beginnings, nor his end. Now, I'm not going to go into this. This particular verse called up for me a whole memory of going through a Bardo experience basically when I was a college student, and I don't know if David has posted that document yet, but I'm not going to tell you this whole story, but I had very tangible, say, personal experience that I relate to this, you know, which is to say that I got sort of swept away by having a breakdown of consciousness that went very slowly. It was like a slow motion dissolution, you know, into the skandhas, and, you know, so I had no training at all at the time. I didn't have any vocabulary for this. I had no idea what was happening to me, and the thing, my main reaction was to push it away, to react against it, because I was very, very frightened by the involuntary nature of it. In other words, the archetypal, the unfolding that I could not stop, that I couldn't intervene. There wasn't anything I could do about it. I just started seeing these things, and they were falling out, obviously, in a certain order. But here's the thing. When I read this passage, and the inner witness shall remain as the knower of all things, well, it reminded me that if I had not had the rudimentary, you know, the beginnings, or like some rudimentary version of an observer, of an inner witness, I would have just simply been swept away, and I just would have been a crazy person, and they would have needed to put me on a lot of Thorazine and maybe confine me with straps or a straitjacket or something, and I just would have been lost in the fantasies. But what actually happened to me, I actually remember when I was going through this, what they called it at the time, you know, when you're a college student, they call it a mental breakdown, at least in the 60s, when you've taken some drugs here and there. But the main sensation that I remember in relation to going through this is being paralyzed, sitting, like literally being stiff, sitting in a chair and not being able to get up, not being able to tell anybody that I couldn't get up, not being able to tell anybody what visions were going through my head. But the thing is that I was somehow observing, you know, I had some I had some fragment of myself that was looking at this and saying, you know, this is not real. this is some kind of illusion that's unraveling. And I realize I only can realize this in retrospect. But if I didn't have some kind of a still point or some kind of an observational point,
wow,
I wouldn't be here to talk about it today.
Wow.
I would just be a crazy person.
Great.
Because I would have been swept away. I would have simply been reborn as, what would I have been reborn as? You know, like maybe a nutty philosopher or something. I don't know. I'd have been reborn as a neurotic person begging on the streets or something. I don't know what. Maybe I wasn't that, you know, I come from a pretty middle class background. So it's not too likely I'd be, become a professional panhandler. But the point that I'm making is that I recognize these things, and I would invite you to read the document and think about whether parts of this book or any of what we read here in this guidebook are open up experiences of your own or memories that you have, you know, which could be karmically charged moments or memories.
Absolutely.
But you see, let me just go on, David. This is just the way this is phrased here. After the knower, and the inner witness shall remain as the knower of all things, and the center of images shall be those of his former surroundings, and he shall not. Okay, so this verse there, I interpreted. I said to myself, "Oh yeah, well I remember this. I went through this complete kind of dissolution of consciousness, and I didn't actually get to the clear light because I was too afraid. I didn't want to merge. I wasn't ready to merge with anything, and I was holding it away from myself. But what I did do was, after the dissolution, I put everything back together again, and the only way I was going to put it back together again was as the same college student that I had been before this process started.
Right.
And the process actually lasted about a week or 10 days.
Wow.
And then I ended up in the psych ward for a couple more weeks because by the time I hadn't slept for 3 or 4 days, they needed to get me down with Thorazine. But I was literally having visions. I mean, at that point I was hallucinating. I was walking around hallucinating, which was exciting, I guess. But I didn't enjoy
it. Frightening, yeah.
Yeah, I didn't enjoy it. It was not enjoyable at all. But the thing is, you know, I could have just, I wouldn't say I had colleagues. There were people, I had some fellow students of mine that I met in that psychiatric ward, you know, didn't stay at the college. They were mustered out, sent home, went to other doctors, went to other hospitals, whatever. I got out, they started me on a very high dose of Thorazine. And then when I got out, I went back and I actually finished this quarter. I got grades, you know, they weren't good grades, but I got grades for that quarter.
Wow.
When I went through this experience. And the thing is, in retrospect, the whole, you know, from this point of view that we're taking in this book, I can see that this is exactly what I did, was I made the center of images those of my former surroundings. I reconstructed it. I put the persona back together again. I ran the persona.
That's right.
But what I put in the document that David is going to post is that all of this was instigated by my sister, who's 2 years younger than I. She, out of the blue, she called me up and said, you know, I have letters of yours. Would you like copies of your letters? And then she sent me Xeroxes of a set of letters, which I had no memory of ever writing to her. I mean, we were very close in childhood. So I wrote her letters from the time I graduated high school up through, for 10 years, up through college and then through living in Tucson, Arizona. Actually, up to the time when I came in contact with the Institute. So I had written her a letter about this. Basically, I had soft-pedaled this breakdown of mine and said, well, I had some trouble and blah, 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 but I'm finishing this semester. So when I read this letter that I wrote to her, it was 1967, and it reminded me of this whole Bardo passage. And in the document that David posted, I called it what happened to me in a near life experience. Because this is actually what it was. It was like, if I had been had any training at all, if anybody had prepped me, you know, or if I had any had done any practice or made any preparation for this, I could have experienced something. What I did do is that it's, you know, my life had been going in this, just like this, like this, like this, like this, and I definitely hit this major snag, and it had to do with burning a lot of karma, and, you know, and I went off, you know, I went off the track
but
that I would
me,
otherwise have followed, I think.
Let me point something out about that.
Yeah.
Even though you had those kinds of that disillusion of personality,
yeah,
your habits carried you through.
Yeah,
the habits of the observer stayed with you and allowed you to reform. You were able to observe yourself. That's from work.
Yeah. Well, I think that's I can from this perspective, this many years later. You know, I see it as, oh yeah, well that I'm a black sheep person. There's a black sheep person because I didn't, you know. Yeah. Because again, those of you who lived through the '60s, you may remember this experience also, where I couldn't, you know, when I looked around me around this time in '66 and '67, '68, I looked around me and I saw these people who were sort of like, oh, let's try this drug, let's try that drug, let's do this, let's do that, let's go to a rock concert, let's see, oh, I saw beautiful rainbow colors and all this. And it was like I had trouble understanding what was going on with them, because when I tried these things, I would have these very strange, you know, basically what we call Bardo experiences. You know, I would have visions and art. It was partly my biochemistry. It didn't take very much of any substance to get me out of an ordinary sort of state of mind into something archetypal and usually quite frightening.
As in the first phrase of Rumi's poem, when you
out in the empty sky.
Yeah.
Well, the point is, I wasn't a meditator. I didn't have any practice. I wasn't.
But you did that.
Spiritual practice.
Reformed, and then eventually wound up here.
Yeah. Well, I think as a college student, I did what I needed to do to survive. It was like the habit was a survival mechanism. But on the other hand, I see much more clearly now that it was that if I hadn't had the impulse or I don't know if it's a habit. Maybe
when I say
it is maybe a habit.
It's like an
inspiration, or it's like genetic. It's like as if in the DNA. Or something from other lifetimes, or from DNA, or whatever. I had the ability to when I was frozen in the chair to sit there and look at this thing and say, "This is a really weird show that I'm being shown."
That's
there.
What I mean.
That's the one, because that's the one that survives and gets, you know, gets.
You didn't black out.
Not only did he not black out, but he had that perspective, and you didn't go where a lot of the other people went and had no perspective, and they just lived in that world. You have perspective.
That's what I'm saying. I actually felt.
I don't know.
I felt that.
I don't know where that comes from.
Yeah.
I'm saying right now, I wonder if that might not have been a essence habit that you carried in that experience with you. That's all.
Maybe.
How are we doing over there, Dan?
Well, Shelley Boyce is suggesting it seems that you also had experience with presence and attention, whether or not you knew it.
Right.
I didn't know it, but there was the rudiments there.
It?
There was something there. Yeah.
Shelley Midway says, "I am not this body. I am not this mind," from a song.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Actually, I would like to. I thought of bringing that song in here, Molly. That's the women's song, and Patricia's telling us the choir is going to sing that with Lily locally here in Grass Valley. Good. And it's because it's a beautiful song. Well, maybe we'll get hold of it another time. Let me finish, say one more thing that I wanted to bring up. Oh, we're out of time, David.
Go ahead.
Well, I just wanted to pose to people, here's the very last of this verse 19. And he shall not know himself, nor shall he know his beginnings, nor his end. So this is the beginning of the visions of the second stage, okay, of the voyage, let's say, in the red ABD. And we talked about this a little bit in our group, and we had our interpretation. We were divided in our interpretation as to whether this is the voyager, and he shall not know himself, nor shall he know his beginnings nor his end. Is this saying that the voyager is now lost in the illusions which he constructs around himself? His surroundings shall be those of his former life, so he doesn't know his true beginnings, his true end as an essential self? Or is it saying that he's not yet in the down spiral of these visions, and if he doesn't know his beginning nor his end, it means he's an unlimited,
right,
essential being? I wonder, you know, it seems a little mysterious to me, that verse at that point. And I wonder what people...
Well, it sounds to me like that's the point where he's on the razor's edge, and it could go one way or the other.
Very good. Okay. So it's an it's the beginning of the intermediate stage of the secondary visions, right? Alchemy. Could you say what your interpretation of that line is? She with us?
Yes, I'm just, yes. Can you hear me?
Yes,
now we can.
Now we can.
Okay.
What did you think it meant to say that he didn't know his beginnings or his end?
I feel that it is when you don't know your beginnings or ends, and when you remain, and say, I mean, I'll just read the paragraph again. It says, and the inner witness shall remain as the knower of all things. And center of images shall be those of his former surroundings. He shall not know himself, nor shall he know his beginnings, nor his end. So when we were initially reading this, it felt like, you know, a little bit of contrasting, you know, it was just saying two different things. How can you remain the knower of all things and yet not know your beginnings nor his end? But I personally, what I feel is that it is only when you are the knower of all things is that you do not know where what begins and where what ends, and that's clear light for me.
Ah, okay. So that's,
I mean,
very,
when the knowledge is so pervasive,
right,
when the knowledge is so pervasive that it is so consuming that, you know, there is no end, this end or horizon or anything. Everything is just clear light all around you. And that's how I interpreted it. But please, it would be wonderful if people could share interpretations, because we were interpreting and reinterpreting this particular paragraph. But yeah, I settled down with this one because it seemed to work for me.
Okay, so this is good. This is what I wanted to bring up. So Alka has an interpretation that this is, that the witness is there, and that even though the surroundings, that the imagery is brought from the former lifetime, basically from the historical personality, let's say, because that inner witness is there, he doesn't know his beginnings or his end because he is still immersed in the clear light.
Yeah.
He's still undifferentiated.
There is no beginning and end.
And to me, say, the whole experience that I was just describing, you know, when I was remembering going through this sort of dissolution of consciousness, I'm thinking that it's, even though there's a witness there, I feel in retrospect, I didn't know my beginnings or my end because I wasn't acknowledging myself or sensing myself as an essence, as a being. I was still holding on to the smaller self.
Well, you didn't have the technology yet.
I'm just saying that's my reading of the...
I know.
That I didn't know my beginning and my end, which were out in the empty sky, let's say. Anyway.
Well, we're going to, how are we doing over there, Dan?
Well, Molly Midway is asking, the clear light blue arrives 1/2 hour after the last out-breath, but before the angel of death takes the soul? And then, it's a moment of possible awakening.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Voyager doesn't know he is dead. And Shelley Boyce is asking, he is the clear light?
Well,
I think this is worthy of meditation.
It's not either or.
I think that's chapter 3, I think.
It's not either or. That is, the Voyager is in action at this point. And part of the Voyager is the clear light. We are in transit. Don't forget where we started with Ula.
Mm-hmm.
And now we go into another area with Rahman about compassion and this other sensitivity. We will get into a different place. You're right, Elka, in book 3.
Or that was, wasn't it somebody there? Shelley?
So, what's happening here is these individuals are making efforts to penetrate the text. The work is done by us individually. You read that paragraph and sit with it.
Mm-hmm.
Sit with it for an hour or two. Carry it around in your pocket during the day. Pull it out and read it. That's the work that happens, and then it becomes, you get deepened by it. You get deepened by it, and you carry it with you, like, So practice. There are no definitive answers in this particular world. This is like the moon on the water.
Mm-hmm.
It appears there, we see it, and then another moment happens. But can we capture it? So we'll continue this a bit next week, as we do more of a general review of book 2 and prepare ourselves for 3.
Yeah.
I don't know what the 3 group, that's George, right?
Right.
You're what, are you a few weeks away, or do you know yet? Or?
No, you know, I think we'll be ready for the week after. We've been planning the week after next, so presuming we finish up with Rockman.
We could talk about this book for another week.
Yeah, but in order to deepen your understanding of it, read some of the material that's actually been written. Take your time to open up to this material. It's worth the read.
Okay.
Finish with a verse.
Go ahead, Ivan, and then we'll call it a night.
Okay, this is just... in the spirit of compassion, I think. Bright morning stars are rising. Bright morning stars are
rising.
Bright morning stars are rising. Daylight is a breaking in my soul. Once more, you want to try it, Alka? I don't know if we can coordinate.
Oh, yes.
Bright morning stars
are rising.
Bright morning stars are rising. Bright morning stars are rising. Daylight is a-breaking in my soul.
Thank you.
Another time.
Thank you, Book 2 group. very entertaining.
It's a joy.
I look forward to seeing you next Wednesday at 7 o'clock. Good night, all.
Good night.
Good night, and thanks.